hope I plugged that in. I'm not sure I did. Yeah, I did. So we'll try and do the only moderately difficult ones. And I try not to repeat, so if you've seen one, you probably aren't going to see it again, but I don't guarantee that, right? Because I can forget which one we did, which one we didn't. I don't think I'll forget today, but... Constellation A. It's got a bright star in it. Well, maybe that's a reasonably good one. Constellation A. Constellation B. I don't know if that's hard or easy. I think that's easy, but, you know, your mileage may vary. Not any particularly bright stars, but not bad. Pretty definite shape. Okay, and then constellation C, one with a bright star in it. That's backwards. It's upside down. Better. So we're doing constellation quizzes. We're currently on constellation C. We'll do them all one more time. People ready to start again? So constellation A had a bright star in it. It's not one that we've seen in lab, I'm pretty sure. I guess we haven't seen anything in lab, have we? Say again? No, I think I've done all of them right. At least the second time I did them right. So there's a constellation that you recognize as being properly oriented. So that one's constellation A. It's got a bright star in it. Reasonably normal sort of shape. And the sky was constellation B. Smallish constellation, no particularly bright stars, but I would say it's got a pretty distinctive shape. And last but not least, the ever-popular constellation can't really tell whether I have it right or not until I look at it. And that's not right. That one's right. See which one? So everyone done with C? So repeats asked for, Abel?
B.
B as in boy. A smallish constellation, no particularly bright stars. Other requests? C, and maybe I'll get it right the first time. Here is constellation C. Got a bright star in it. Other requests. Okay, pass them that away. C has given you trouble? I would say people had more trouble this time than last time. So, constellation A was... Well, let's do constellation C since it's sitting here already. It's Leo. So, here's the... Here's Regulus, and here's the head of the lion. Here's the tail of the lion. How about A? Which one was that? Cygnus, right? Northern Cross is a perfectly good name for it, too. Bright Star Deneb.
This one. I couldn't decide between Aquila or Bodis.
Well, it didn't matter.
Either way,
it was wrong. Cassiopeia.
Oh my God.
Or no. Sorry. Sagittarius.
Sagittarius.
I was about to say, like, who was Cassiopeia?
Can you draw the line? I don't see how it's going on.
So this is a teapot, right? So here's the spout, here's the top, here's the handle of the teapot.
Sagittarius. That's disappointing.
So this is what I was trying to have work last time for me, right? It's a pretty familiar color, I hope, to you. That's neon. I guess I can bring things back to... Questions about anything? So I can see kind of from the lineup, we got Night Labs starting next week. Constellation Snow Quiz, obviously, will continue. Home Lab 2 scans are due before spring break. What else is on the list? So we're going to have sometime we want to have a kind of a big quiz on all of this stuff. And the idea is kind of review it before the exam. And there are kind of two options, and I'm not super happy with either of them. So we could do it the Monday right after spring break. And that I don't like because people never do well on exams right after breaks, right? Everyone thinks they're going to study. No one does. The other possibility is Wednesday, but then it'll be tough to get it back before the exam. And then kind of the whole purpose is lost. So I could maybe get it back before the help session, but you know a lot of you won't be attending the help session. So I don't know, I'm not looking for an answer, but maybe I'll ask for a vote on it, something like that as time goes on. So that's kind of a big 30-point quiz on spectra, atomic structure, telescopes, everything we're gonna cover before the exam. Questions? So HomeLab 2 scans were due long ago. HomeLab 1 scans are the next thing that's due. So, you know, I'll still look at HomeLab 2 scans if you have, but it's been cloudy, so it's been hard to do it anyway. And the deal is we need a big time span. For HomeLab 1, we just need a month before the end of classes. For HomeLab 2, we really need 2 months. And we're running out of time. Okay, so we were looking at types of spectra. So spectra are plots of the amount of light versus wavelength or frequency. We usually plot them versus wavelength. And all of the colors in the rainbow, the normal incandescent light bulb, that's what we call a continuous spectra. And those things are also called the incandescent light sources, thermal spectra, black body spectra. Planck is the dead physicist who figured out the shape of the curve. And before we said that kind of the characteristics of those curves are that the total amount of light depends very sensitively on temperature. Higher temperature, more light at every color. And technically speaking, you get T to the fourth. So if you double the temperature, you get 16 times as much light. And the location of the peak in terms of wavelength depends inversely on the temperature. So higher temperatures correspond to shorter wavelengths, say shifting from red to blue. So continuous is all of the colors mixed together. If we look at a spectra of the sun, what we see is pretty much all of the colors together with just a few colors that are missing and therefore look black. So right in the middle of yellow, we see a couple of lines called the D lines that particular wavelengths are not present. And that's because those colors are being absorbed by stuff in the atmosphere of the sun. So these are called absorption spectra. And you can see what the corresponding situation is we have a wavelength at which light is missing. So we have less amount of light at that particular wavelength. The other possibility is the sometimes called bright line spectra or emission spectra, where if we looked at that neon bulb, for example, we would see mostly black. That is to say, lots of these colors are not being produced by the light bulb. But at a few wavelengths, we'd see a certain amount of light. Okay, so continuous, emission, absorption, pretty common sorts of spectra, and we saw them all represented before. So we had the continuous spectra of the incandescent light bulbs. The reveal light bulbs had absorption lines in the yellow. And I'm not sure you could actually see the spectra given the dim light sources from the spectral tubes. So of course, in order to do this, we had to be able to break light up according to its color. Prism is kind of the traditional way of doing it. It's not particularly effective. It doesn't break up the colors very much. But it does break up 100% of the light. So kind of the alternative and what we used, in fact, was a diffraction grating. Just consists of lots of closely spaced lines, kind of like a CD. And they had kind of reverse effects. The diffraction grating bent the red more than the blue, whereas the prism bent the blue more than the red. But the diffraction was not efficient in the sense that most of the light was not affected. So big effect, but only with a small fraction of the light. Prism, small effect, but it at least affected 100% of the light. Polarization. Things like thermal sources have randomly oriented electric fields. If we can arrange them all to be pointing in the same direction, then we have polarization. It happens as a result of reflection. It can also happen because of fancy material like Polaroid filters, and it's not present in incandescent objects. Questions? So, kind of the main topic today is how is it that atoms can act like tuned instruments in that they are able to absorb or emit just particular frequencies or wavelengths of light? What's special about them that does that? And that's going to be kind of a longish story. I want to start by talking about the states of matter. So I'm sure you all know about solids and liquids. and gases. So in the case of a solid, we have a rigid array of the atoms in what's called a lattice. In the case of a gas, we have atoms that are just flying around, basically ignoring each other with great distances between their centers. And liquid is kind of the in-between case. So if you think about a crowd of people leaving a theater or something, you're probably going to stay close to the person who's near you, but there isn't any particular relationship between you. And if you move fast, maybe you'll get away from that particular person. And we want to add to this another state of matter called plasma. It turns out that plasma is the most common state of matter, and it consists of ionized gas. So that begs the question about what ionized gas is. So in this picture we have of an atom, which you know I'm going to tell you is wrong eventually, right? We have electrons, which are negatively charged particles that are orbiting the nucleus, which is positively charged, opposites attract, so it kind of produces a situation that's analogous to the solar system, where the sun is gravitationally attracting the planets. Typically, there's as much positive charge in the nucleus as there are negatively charged electrons. So as a whole, this thing adds up to zero. It has no net charge. An ion is a case where one of these electrons has been ejected from the composite. And so as a result, what's left over has, say, a positive charge. So that would be a positively charged ion. You can also have the reverse happen. You can have an extra electron orbiting around the nucleus, in which case we're going to have a negatively charged ion. In chemistry, positively charged ions and negatively charged ions occur about equally. In real life, the positively charged ions are way more common than the negatively charged ions. So what's the difference between these states of matter? How do we go from one state to another? And I've got kind of another one of these cheesy demonstrations that is supposed to show you what's going on. And as you go through this order, if you think about water, for example, it can exist in solid form as ice, it can exist as liquid water, it can exist as vapor. And if you heat it up hot enough, it can become a plasma. And I guess I already said that the difference between these states has to do with the temperature. Yeah, I really should do something like call them to change the filter. I'm being bad. Ooh, maybe I'll pay for it. I think it'll work. Oh, yeah, it'll never work if I do that. They've changed this on me too. So here we have water. So here is the oxygen atom, and here are the two hydrogen atoms that make up H2O. And I have the ability to change the temperature in this demo, and we can kind of see how this works. So currently we have a lattice of water molecules, but there's a little bit of vibration around the equilibrium points. If I increase the temperature a little bit, come on. Here we have more vibration about the equilibrium point, and I guess I would call that liquid. We can go a little bit more and have even more liquid. Things are kind of bouncing around. Notice that they're sitting on the bottom of the container, which is what we would think liquid water is going to do. If we increase the temperature even more, we start to get some evaporated water. So we still have water on the bottom, but we also have water vapor that's floating around. If we increase the temperature enough, 100% of the water becomes in the vapor state. And as we increase the temperature some more, you'll notice that the atoms are being broken, the molecules are being broken apart. So now we've got hydrogen atoms that are flying around in addition to oxygen atoms and things that are still connected as H2O. And if we heat it hot enough, we'll break everything apart and we'll start to produce ionized material. So what causes the difference in the state of matter is temperature. If we're talking about a low temperature material, the only thing that's happening is the lattice is vibrating a little bit. But as we add more and more energy, the temperature goes up more and more and more. That is to say, approximately speaking, what temperature is it's the energy per particle. So if we give these particles enough energy, they're going to break out of the lattice. They're eventually going to break out of the liquid state. Come on. So here we should, yeah, there's no evaporation yet, I guess. Now we're getting some evaporation. We still have some liquid on the bottom. 100% gas vapor, and then we start to break things apart. Okay, so temperature is a measurement of the energy per particle. As we go to higher and higher energies, we get more and more motion, kinetic energy. So what we have here is the temperature. So we know that's an intensive variable, right? So it's the ratio of two extensive variables. So it's basically the total energy divided by the number of particles. So it's the energy per particle. And as we increase the energy to particle, we can break apart composites. And that's going to be kind of a mantra for how things work. Higher temperatures break apart composites. And there's a very similar mantra that has to do with the second law of thermodynamics, and that is that at high temperatures, nature favors disorder. Whereas at low temperatures, nature favors things getting in the lowest available energy state. There's a $2 word for disorder. It's entropy. So at high temperatures, we've got lots of disorder, lots of entropy. At low temperatures, we have an organized state. That is to say, we have low entropy, and things are in the lowest available state. All of the bonds are saturated. Okay, so stuff is made out of molecules that might be in a lattice in the case of a solid. They might be in a liquid in the case at higher temperatures. They might be in gaseous form. All of that just has to do with a temperature. But basically, stuff is made out of molecules. And as in the case of H2O, what a molecule consists of is atoms stuck together. And as I'm sure you learned in high school, what I mean by an atom are the things that are on the periodic table. In some sense, the fundamental particles of chemistry, at least, things that are stuck together. And as I think we said last time, we've appropriated a Greek idea of something that is unbreak-apartable, but we've already seen that atoms can be broken apart into ions and electrons. So they're not the atoms of Greek mythology. They're some kind of composite that we've appropriated the name of. Okay, so what's an atom? We've already said that an atom is a positively charged nucleus plus orbiting electrons. And you remember that, I mean, this part needs some explanation in the future, because something that is literally orbiting should be accelerating and therefore should be radiating. And turns out, you can do the calculations, the electrons should spiral into the nucleus in about a billionth of a second. So something a little bit special is going on there. Okay, so these things aren't the atoms of the Greeks yet. If we look inside the nucleus, what we find is there are neutrons and protons. And so roughly speaking, a neutron or a proton weighs about 2,000 times the mass of an electron. So almost all of the mass is in the nucleus. That's what Rutherford discovered. The positively charged pieces of it are protons. The electrically neutral parts of it are called neutrons. And those things are kind of packed cheek to jowl inside the nucleus. So if we're thinking about a chemical element, for example, carbon, carbon in its normal state has 6 protons and 6 neutrons. But that's not the only possible form of carbon. Carbon can have 6 protons and 7 neutrons. Can also have 6 protons and 8 neutrons. So these are all elements that behave chemically the same. That is to say, if you were to eat a hamburger made out of this, it would taste just the same as a hamburger made out of that. So chemically, these things are more or less the same. Why? Because all of these guys have 6 protons and hence normally have 6 orbiting electrons. And it's the electrons that determine the chemical properties of the material. So the most important number here, so-called atomic number, is the number of protons. Every chemical element has exactly a particular number of hydrogen atoms, of protons. So for example, hydrogen has an atomic number of 1, and that means it always has 1 proton. It can have 1 proton and nothing else. It can have a proton and a neutron. It can have a proton and 2 neutrons. All of those are more or less stable forms of hydrogen. We'll need names for some of these eventually. It's not particularly important now. But this one is sometimes called heavy hydrogen or deuterium. And this one, which is more unstable, is called tritium. But they're all hydrogen. And they all act more or less like hydrogen. And since they have atomic number 1, they're the first thing on the periodic table. Helium is the next thing on the periodic table. It has 2 protons. And almost all helium on Earth also has 2 neutrons. But if you're willing to pay the price, you can get some helium that has just 1 neutron in it. Okay, so forms of the same chemical element that have different number of neutrons are called different isotopes. And we distinguish them by the total number of things that are in the nucleus, sometimes called the atomic weight. So carbon, technically speaking, has 6 protons. This type of carbon has 6 protons and 12 total things in the nucleus, so it's called carbon 12. This one is called carbon 13. This one is called carbon 14. I think in our book they like to put the 12 on the other side of the symbol. Technically speaking, that's not correct, but it's not uncommon. And we always say the number second, not first, so it kind of makes more sense to put the 12 on the other side, carbon 12, as opposed to 12 carbon. Okay. So isotopes are things that have the same number of protons but different numbers of neutrons. So carbon 12, carbon 13, carbon 14 are all isotopes of carbon.
So the same number of what? Sorry?
Protons. Protons determine the positive charge on the nucleus and hence the number of electrons and hence the chemical properties. So isotopes would all have pretty much the same chemical properties as the most common isotope, which for carbon 12, which for carbon is carbon 12. And for hydrogen is hydrogen 1. And something like 1% of the hydrogen is deuterium. And tritium is pretty rare. For helium, helium 3 is way rarer than helium 4. There's kind of a shortage of helium 3. So the first thing to say is it's tough to distinguish them because chemically they're the same. So you hand them to a chemist, he says same thing. But there have to be some way of distinguishing because I distinguished them, right? So they weigh different amounts, but generally speaking, that's a pretty subtle property. But the kind of the first time that these things were separated, they were separated based on their weights in a really tough process. But they have a variety of slightly different properties. And as you might guess, two isotopes that are the most different would be hydrogen and deuterium, because deuterium weighs twice as much as hydrogen. So there are kind of noticeable differences between hydrogen and deuterium. Whereas between carbon 13, carbon 14, carbon 12, it takes a lot more work. So I don't know if I'm hinting around this or not. The World War II, there was great interest in making bombs, and in particular, so-called atomic bombs, which are really nuclear bombs. And you may know that uranium is a key player in all of this. And the most common isotope of uranium is 238, and that doesn't make bombs. If you want to make bombs, you want 235 or 233, but 233 is even rarer. So there was a big process that was involved in taking uranium that was mined and was almost all 238 and getting through physical processes the small fraction of it that was 235 that you could make bombs out of.
Can you do that through splitting a hydrogen atom, like a hydrogen bomb?
Well, so splitting. So the $2 word for splitting is fission. And putting things together, the $2 word for that is fusion. And the original World War II bombs, which were based on uranium and plutonium, those do involve splitting, and we'll talk more about that eventually. The hydrogen bomb doesn't involve splitting because there's nothing to split, right? Typically hydrogen, and the hydrogen in a hydrogen bomb in particular, is mostly protons. So you don't split, you put them together. So a hydrogen bomb is a fusion bomb in which we get energy by putting together hydrogen atoms to make helium, for example. Whereas the so-called atomic bomb, nuclear bomb of World War II, the uranium bomb, was based on fission, breaking stuff apart. And that should sound a little bit funny. So you can get energy by putting things together and taking them apart. So that needs some explanation, but and we'll hopefully get to that today, but maybe not immediately. Maybe I'll make one more remark, and that is that you talked about hydrogen bombs. The thing that's most important to us is the sun. That's where basically all the energy we have on Earth comes from eventually. And that's also based on fusion. That's hydrogen becoming helium. So there were natural fission reactors billions of years ago, just based on the normal amount of U-235 that's present. But approximately speaking, fusion is what happens naturally, and fission has required some sort of human intervention. More questions? Okay, well, we said what's inside the nucleus. What's inside an electron? Well, nothing yet. So there are lots of people who think that there is something inside of an electron, and these guys go under the name of string theorists, and the idea is there might be little vibrating strings inside of electrons, but there's absolutely no sign of that currently. Electrons seem to be elementary particles that, try as we can, we've never broken them apart. That doesn't apply to neutrons and protons. So if we take neutrons or protons, we find that they are composite particles. So a proton, it consists of two up quarks and a down quark. Whereas a neutron consists of two down quarks and an up quark. And those quarks are sitting cheek to jowl with each other, held extremely strongly together. Well, what's inside of a quark? Well, the same applies to quarks as applies to electrons. As far as we can tell, currently there's nothing inside of a quark, but there are people, incidentally, does it include me or not? I don't know. There's no current evidence for strings. And much has been promised and nothing has been produced by the string theorists for approximately 30 years. So a degree of skepticism is, I think, required. Well, so quarks and electrons are the real atoms, right? As far as we can tell, those things can't be broken apart. Everything else are these pseudo-atoms that we took over this idea from the Greeks from, because they were kind of approximate atoms. So what does the real periodic table look like? Right? Not that one. Those things can be broken apart, but the real one. So we're going to distinguish two types of these real atoms. We've got quarks. And so far, we've got up and down quarks, and we've got what are called leptons. And so far, we've got electrons. The up quark has a charge of plus 2/3. The down quark has a charge of minus 1/3. And they differ, of course, by 1. And if you do the math, two ups and a down, that's going to be 2/3 plus 2/3 minus 1/3. That equals 1, which is what we would get for a proton. And for a neutron, we got minus 1/3 minus 1/3 plus 2/3. Nice and neutral. So I've obviously left a blank space because quarks and leptons are kind of paired up. And there is a particle, so these guys differ by 1, and this guy has a charge of minus 1, so this guy should have a neutral charge. So we had the neutron, this is the neutrino. Seems to be very much like an electron, except it's electrically neutral. It has a much smaller mass than an electron, so most commonly it travels at close to the speed of light, contrary to what you might have heard a year ago. But otherwise, it seems to be very similar to an electron. Surprisingly, you haven't heard of these guys, but there are zillions of them going through your body every second. Every cubic centimeter has hundreds of them in it. But because they're electrically neutral, they don't do much. So they go through your body all the time without causing much effect. Well, much to the surprise of the physicists, circa 1940, another particle that was just like the electron was found, and it's called the muon. And it has to have a partner. We still call it a neutrino. It's a muon neutrino as opposed to an electron neutrino. In the 1950s, people started finding some strange particles, and they needed a strange quark to be the source of this strangeness. And then in 1976, people found a charming quark. It was charming because at that point the pattern became clear. Without the charmed quark, things were pretty, people had lots of theories, but once you see that much, it's pretty clear that you're going to see repetitions of these paired pairs. So the charm quark kind of explains, and I should say, the charm quark is just like the up quark, it has a charge of plus 2/3. Strange quark is just like the down quark, it has a charge of minus 1/3. And there's one more repetition of this, and people who, you know, kind of like the charmed idea call these things top and bottom, but, call these truth and beauty, but, I've never liked those names. So I go top and bottom, which, I don't know, 60% of physicists do. So this is the tau. This was the last one of these guys discovered. I forget exactly when, 1990, something like that. But the picture was perfectly clear, really, by 1980, that exactly these three groups of four had to exist, and that there is almost certainly nothing more to the periodic table, that it ends at three. Okay, so material might be solid, liquid, or gas. It's made out of molecules. Molecules are made out of atoms. Atoms are made out of nuclei and electrons, nothing inside electrons. Nucleus is made out of neutrons and protons. Neutrons and protons are made out of quarks. And that's as far as we found so far. Well, yes? Say again?
For the last quarks.
Yeah, so I like top and bottom, but some people call it truth and beauty. People got into the charming names more so than I like. And lots of other people. It was very popular on the West Coast to call them truth and beauty. I go charm, the charm quark, believe me, is charming. It deserves its name, and the strange quark is strange. But there isn't anything truthy about the truth quark. It's just another repetition. It's pretty dull.
What holds the quarks together in the protons and
neutrons? So we got an earlier problem, right? What holds the protons together inside of a nucleus, right? Because they have the same electric charge, they want to repel. And as you say, we've got a repetition of the same thing. We've got three quarks, and I said that they were tightly bound together, but I didn't say what was doing the binding. Well, it's not gravity, and it's not electricity. Right, so it's got to be something new. So as far as we can figure out, and we're reasonably sure about this, there are exactly four forces. Right, so we've got gravity. Newton had kind of the first word about that, and Einstein, I'm not sure I would say the last word, but the most recent word that we fully trust. Incidentally, the string theorists have a lot to say about gravity too, but I've expressed my skepticism about that already. We've got electricity, But Maxwell in 1860 showed us that electricity and magnetism were really part of the same thing. So there is a force of electricity and magnetism. Sometimes electrical forces look like magnetic forces. Sometimes magnetic forces look like electrical forces. It all just kind of depends on your point of view. There's really only one thing going on there. So we've got two remaining slots, and how about weak and strong? Pretty good generic names. So obviously we need a strong force to keep these protons stuck together, to keep the quarks stuck together. So that's going to be our candidate. Sometimes this is called the strong nuclear force because it's what holds together the nucleus. These days, a better name for it is the color force. Well, maybe I'll explain that. What's the weak force about? So the weak force, the strong force we see as a push or a pull. The weak force, even though it can cause pushes and pulls, because it's so weak, we don't really think about it as doing that sort of thing. Instead, we usually experience the weak force as a transforming force. So what the weak force does is it can transform these pairs into other pairs. So for example, what the weak force can do is it can take a down quark and in the process turn it into an up quark. Now you can see that electrical charge currently isn't conserved, right? So I have to have a negatively charged particle produced. I can't make particles out of nothing, so I have to have an antiparticle kind of to go along with it. So the weak force transforms pairs of quarks and in the process transforms pairs of leptons. And we see this then in the process that happens spontaneously. If you watch a neutron that's not in a nucleus for about 1,000 seconds, you'll find that it spontaneously decays into a proton and an electron and an antineutrino. Right? So fundamentally what's happening is we've got so-called spectator quarks, right, a down and an up. And this down has become this up, and in the process we've converted a neutron to a proton. You might know that carbon-14 spontaneously decays. It's used for dating that we'll talk about a month from now. Same thing. What's happening is a neutron is becoming a proton because of the weak force, and so as a result, carbon-14 is becoming nitrogen-14 and emitting an electron and a neutrino. So the weak force, it does cause pushes or pulls, but we kind of don't see them. We usually see this transformative process of the weak force. And most of what goes under the name of radioactive decay is caused by the weak force. So the thing that gravity acts on, we call mass. The thing that electricity and magnetism acts on, we call charge. What is the thing that the strong force acts on? So it's a little bit different in the sense that mass is what you would call a real number, and charge is what you would call a real number. The color force, well, I guess I've let the cat out of the bag. This is called color. And it's fundamentally a two-dimensional quantity as opposed to a one-dimensional quantity. For the weak force, we have the name weak charge, right? Not very creative, but same sort of thing. So as far as we can figure out, everything is explained by these four forces acting on this periodic table of real atoms. Acting together. Now, having said that, well, not too long ago, somebody mentioned the name photon. And we said that a photon was basically an atom of light. It's the smallest piece of light that you can have. And that doesn't quite fit into my claim that this is everything, if there are photons. And it turns out that photons are kind of the realization of pure electricity and magnetism. And in a similar sort of way, we can have a realization of pure strong force. It's called the gluon, because it does such a great job of gluing things together. A weak force seems to not have such creative names. Equivalent thing are called the W and the Z. The W comes in plus minus charge varieties, and the Z is neutral. So there ought to be a realization of just gravity. And it's going to be real hard to discover, but we at least have a name for it. It's going to be called the graviton. And I can make lots of predictions about how it acts and works. I'm pretty confident about those predictions. But I don't know. I don't expect ever to live to see gravitons exactly discovered. But gravity waves, which are lots of gravitons acting together, you can take your pick. Either they have been discovered or they're about to be discovered. That's, I guess, a confusing statement, but it's a true statement. Better than making a false statement. And I guess I would say they've been discovered, but people would disagree with me. Okay, so structure of matter, that's what it all is. What does this all have to do with the tuned instrument stuff? Well, so everything was good in the world up to about 1900. Newton explained how everything worked, and if we didn't worry a whole lot about atoms, which maybe didn't even exist in 1900, we didn't have any problems. But circa 1900, there started to be some cracks in the explanation for how the universe works. And there are kind of two versions of this. One has to do with, approximately speaking, the small. And I'm not super happy about saying that, because we think quantum mechanics applies to everything. It's just that it's most obvious when it's small. And the other big revolution has to do, goes under the name of relativity, and that has to do with the fast. And same thing applies to it. I don't really happy saying that it applies only to the fast. It applies all the time. It's just that it's most relevant when things are moving fast. So the fundamental problem that quantum mechanics was supposed to solve for us is why the atom is stable. So, incidentally, the same process that I'm worried about with emitting light from accelerating electrons should apply to gravity, right? The orbiting planet should emit gravitational waves. But it turns out that the rate of emission of gravitational waves is so slow that the orbits are stable for not just billions of years, but billions and billions and billions of years. So there should be gravitational radiation and hence the falling of orbiting planets, but not on a time scale like for electrons, where it's a billionth of a second. And if if we're going to have an explanation, what has to be the case is there can't be any changing charge. It can't be that the charge is there, 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 and there, because that moving electron would constitute an acceleration it should radiate. So static, that is to say unchanging, electrons are required. And that's really hard to understand, right? Because we got positive and negative, boom, they should attract. So how is it that we can have something about the electrons being unchanging and still not have them collapse into on top of the nucleus? And the answer is that the basic idea of an electron or anything else being a particle, right, a particle is something that has a place. Right, that's like centrifugal. It doesn't exist. There's nothing that has a place. Things that we think about having a location don't really have a location. They're always spread out. And how something can be spread out is if it's a wave. So instead of thinking about an electron as being a point particle, we have to think about it as kind of like a ripple on the water. Maybe it's confined a little bit to some region where the ripple exists, but in detail, it doesn't have a place. It's in all of those places more or less simultaneously, the way a wave is. And what we have then for an atom is an electron that is in a static wave that is surrounding the nucleus and is in fact penetrating the nucleus. I don't mean to be avoiding the nucleus. Nucleus is pretty small, so it doesn't run into it very often, but electrons are running through the nucleus all the time, no problem. So the idea here is we've got a cloud. The electron can't really be localized. It's all over the place at the same time. There's a famous principle due to a famous dead physicist, Heisenberg, that says if you try and localize any particle, automatically you become uncertain about its momentum in an amount that depends on some particular number that you could look up in books, which is called Planck's constant, the same Planck that this guy is. You can't simultaneously know the position and the velocity of a particle because they're fundamentally not particles. They're fundamentally waves. So we should think about standing waves. So if you think about shaking a string, there are certain wave frequencies that work with that string and there are others that don't. So sometimes the electron can be in I'll call it the ground state. And if you will, you should think about this as a string that is vibrating in kind of the simplest possible way. If we give it more energy, then the string can vibrate in a different way. Right? So we would end up, it turns out, with a cloud that is kind of oriented kind of like that. The chemists like to call these orbitals. Sometimes really stupid chemists call these shells. Mostly dead stupid chemists. So the electron can be in various possible states, And these states require more and more energy. So just as I can get this string vibrating in various possible ways, I can have various possible states of this electron cloud that's surrounding the nucleus. Takes more energy. In fact, it takes a definite amount of energy. But it's otherwise a static situation, and so it's not going to radiate. So the cloud of electrons isn't radiating because it's not changing. And so it can be stable. So we have, the cloud is, it's pretty hard to draw on the blackboard. And so instead of focusing on the shape of the cloud, we focus on the energy. So the lowest possible state, this kind of spherically symmetric state, we're going to call that the ground state. And other ways the electron can vibrate, those are called excited states. And it's not correct, but boy, it's very convenient to think about these as kind of being different, literally, orbits. So they're not really orbits, but it's tempting to think about them as orbits, where we have the electron just further and further and further from the nucleus. And that's the basis of pictures like this. So if an electron changes its cloud from a cloud like this to a cloud like that, then a certain amount of energy has to be given off. And that energy, since it's electromagnetic in origin, is given in the form of light. A photon, the smallest part of light, is given off. Now, you remember long ago we noticed that the high frequency lights were the dangerous types of light and the low frequency lights were not dangerous. That's because there's a relationship between the energy of a photon, how hard it punches, and the frequency. That's the same constant H that I mentioned before. But we don't really care about these equations. The main thing to recognize is if we have a higher frequency photon, the corresponding energy is higher. So it turns out, this is supposed to be hydrogen, that this jump from the ground state to the next highest state, that always produces ultraviolet light. And of course, this is even going to be more energy if it's falling through more a range. The red color that you saw when you looked at the emitting hydrogen came from a jump between n equals 3 and n equals 2. And then you might remember that there was kind of a bluish line and then kind of a violet line. Those came from bigger and bigger jumps. So the size of the jump determines the color of light that's emitted. And I use the color generically, right? Because ultraviolet light doesn't have a color. So maybe more technically, I should say the size of the jump determines the energy of the photon, and the energy of the photon determines the frequency and wavelength of the corresponding photon. Jumps way out here, which have been detected, actually out to like n equals 100, those are going to correspond to very low energy, very low frequency, and actual radio waves would be produced by these sorts of jumps. Okay, so the wave, the standing wave pattern of these electrons about a nucleus, just as different instruments have different patterns, same thing with these guys. The energies that would be associated with chlorine jumps would be totally different from the energy jumps associated with hydrogen. And so chlorine is going to produce different colors when it's excited compared to hydrogen. So every chemical element is going to have kind of a fingerprint of the colors that it produces when the electrons are excited. Okay, so we got more of these kind of cheesy demonstrations. So why didn't the screensaver come on now? Mystery. Well, let's see. I'm not sure that's the one I want. Okay. So, yeah, I know about the filter. Just haven't done anything about it. So here we have, again, this is not a correct picture, but it's a very easy picture to understand. So I'm not opposed to it. So here we have the electron in its ground state. When I push this button, I can have the electron pushed out to a higher energy state. And when it falls back down, as it typically does in a billionth of a second or so, it's going to emit a particular color of light. So that was a two-step process. One of them produced this kind of violet line. That was an ultraviolet photon that went from n equals 2 to n equals 1. So there we got this kind of tealish line that I think came from a jump from there to there. We're kind of looking for this jump here. That should make the red line, which is about at 650, should be about there. There we got it. Okay, so much fun, right? You see the if you're looking at this picture, you can see the electron going to a high energy state, and then as it falls back down, the energy jump determines the corresponding color of the light that's going to be emitted. And different elements would have different vibration frequencies and would have totally different energy levels, totally different colors of light that's produced. Okay, so what we've been talking about here is emission of photons. How about absorption of photons? So here I've got this cheesy demo, and the same process works in reverse. If you can, by falling down, emit a photon, then by eating that photon, you can go in the reverse direction. And so what we have here is photons that go by, that one didn't do anything, that one was absorbed and it knocked the electron up to a high energy state, and then it came down in lots of different ways, emitting various other sorts of light. The only colors of light that will be absorbed are ones that carry exactly the right amount of energy to transform an electron, say, from the ground state to one of these excited states. That's so exciting, we'll want to do it again. Okay, so we said that something in the sun's atmosphere is absorbing particular colors of light. This is exactly what's going on. The light is trying to escape. It's being interrupted by exciting these electrons. And then the electrons, if they go back to exactly the same place, they're just going to emit an exactly same color of light. But often they don't go to the exactly same place. They take a different way down. And so they're going to emit multiple photons of different colors that don't match the color of the original photon. And let me again remind you of this sort of picture. You should think about light from a star as coming in different colored photons, different wavelengths of photons. In this case, we have all of the colors of the rainbow. And if I insert something that will absorb particular colors, and do notice that we see the scattered light just as we did a moment ago. We have these particular colors being eaten by the gas and hence not getting to the telescope, and hence we see the dark absorption line in our spectra. Okay, so see you again next week.